On this episode of Comedy Rewind, does 10 Things I Hate About You get overshadowed by the raunchier teen comedies of the 1990s? Where does Heath Ledger's Hollywood debut rate amongst his most memorable performances? Isn't it wrong to flash a schoolteacher? All of this and more on Comedy Rewind.
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 Push rewind. I thought this was a comedy show.
What's going on, guys? Welcome back to Comedy Rewind. We are powered by Audio Technica as we rewatch the great comedies of the 1990s. I'm your host, John O'Peck, and joining me today, a guy who would flash someone to get you out of detention, it's Simon Blackburn, the host of Take My Tone podcast. How you doing, Simon?
Yeah, pretty good. I like the little tie-in there to the movie we're about to discuss.
Would you flash your nips to get a good friend out of detention?
I mean, there's not much to look at, but sure.
We'll get to that later because what an interesting scene that is.
Yes,
to rewatch now especially. But we are talking about 10 Things I Hate About You, the 1999. I guess it's a teen comedy. Simon, you mentioned this last time we podcasted together on The Mask as another one of your, I guess, favorite comedies of the era. What is it about this movie that kind of made you pinpoint that one as another episode you wanted to do?
I think this is probably the first rom-com that I really attached myself to. And funnily enough, the gateway into even wanting to watch it is the actor Larissa Olenek, who is more commonly known as Alex Mack. So I was a big fan of Alex Mack. And she's obviously older in this as Bianca Stratford. But it was a case of, it came out in 99. I didn't actually see it till 2000 because my sister bought the VHS she saw at the cinema and brought it home. And then just between the year 2000 and pretty much all through me growing up through high school, it just became the go-to highly rewatchable film amongst myself and my siblings. So not my parents, but my siblings. So over the course of time, that span of kind of like, four or five years, it's just become so quotable. It's sort of like my precursor to Mean Girls. I put this in the what I count as like the ultimate sort of trilogy of highly rewatchable rom-coms. So 10 Things I Hate About You, Mean Girls, and Easy A. They're to me are like all quite evenly matched.
That's a good trio, especially for like high school, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. I guess that obviously is a common theme. They're all sort of like similarly spaced apart in years. But and of course, this was actually my entrance point to Heath Ledger, really, in a film. I'd seen him in, he did little stints in Home and Away, like most Australian actors do, and things like that. But I hadn't actually properly seen him in a film until this. And then I really enjoyed his performance. So sort of like after this point, I then went back and watched like Two Hands and various other stuff that he's been in. And this is obviously before Dark Knight even came out too. So, plenty to talk about, plenty of familiar faces in it. And it's just very much a highly rewatchable favorite.
It is super rewatchable. Like, that's one of the things that struck me. I'll probably make a couple comparisons as we talk to American Pie because it came out in 1999, the same year. And it was equally, American Pie was a lot more popular than this for some reason. It made $235 million. 10 Things I Hate About You made $53 million. And I find that crazy because I think this is such a better movie.
Oh, instantly. Like, and yes, absolutely. And this is aged so much better as well.
Oh yeah, like we did American Pie in one of the early episodes of this podcast, and it was a cheaper movie as well, so that stands out more now. Obviously they both have casts that have gone on to do a lot, and they were, you know, there's some great comedic performances in both movies, but maybe it was the raunchiness of American Pie that appealed to teenagers at the time. I think this movie just has aged so much better. And watching it for the first time in a long time, I was like, I just love this movie. I realized I love it. It's so good.
And I think what really helps is obviously it's got the PG rating. It touches on some themes, but the comedy aspect takes a bit more of a backseat as opposed to American Pie just going for that shock factor.
Yeah, It's clever. This is a clever movie.
Exactly. And I think the acting overall is far superior. So, yeah, I'm happy to talk more about it.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned some of the performers in this movie, Heath Ledger being, I guess, the main one that's gone on to do a lot. But compared to American Pie, like, this has a bunch of people who have gone on to be huge. And if they're not huge, they're extremely talented dramatic actors.
Yes.
You know, Julia Stiles, this was, I think, her first probably notable film because she was only 17 when they filmed it.
Wow. Yeah.
I think from my research. Heath Ledger, obviously, you mentioned being your introduction to him, but I think it was probably the world's introduction, unless you were a movie buff that had caught him in some of his earlier work.
Mm.
And he is so good. Like, something. Him and Julia Stiles, like, watching this and not being someone that's followed her career closely, like, she's probably made movies that, like, she didn't go down the path that people might have thought she would after this movie came out. She has been more of a dramatic actor. She did the Bourne movies, obviously. And it was just, like, clear from this. She is super talented and was so sure of herself in this role, and it just felt so authentic. And that's a word that I am going to talk a bit more about later, is the authenticity of this as a teen movie. Even though these guys are mostly in their 20s, you got to think, by the time the filming comes around. And Joseph Gordon-Levitt, like, I love this guy. I love 500 Days of Summer. That's probably my favorite rom-com.
Oh, okay, and wow. Yep.
He's obviously so good in that, and he's done these movies like in Inception and Looper and whatever else he's been up to in the last kind of 10 years. He's become quite big. You know, he was in the Batman movies as well. Kind of tying back to Heath Ledger too in The Dark Knight
Rises. Exactly. You got that sort of return with the Batman tie-in, and the fact that as well you have long-haired Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Third Rock from the Sun, and then this is like his transition. He's like halfway point between that kid and the much physically more fit and kind of manly, but without being too manly. That you get in these sorts of those aforementioned movies. So I just think he's just got such a lovable baby face in this. He's just so. He's
doe-eyed. Yeah,
he's so relatable as well, and that is such a big part of this film in general, is that just that relatability. I think, of just thinking of all those awkward ways of trying to get someone's attention in high school and all that sort of stuff. So I love that, and I think that rings true. Would still ring true to high schoolers today.
Yeah, definitely. I think it says a lot about us that we would relate to him probably the most in this movie. But yeah, it's interesting that him and, you mentioned, Larissa Olenek being probably the ones that we knew about from their TV shows, Third Rock from the Sun and The Secret World of Alex Mack.
Yes.
But the movie starts off focusing on them, but there's a bit of a bait and switch where suddenly Julia Stiles and Heath Ledger become obvious main characters in this movie. And I think that's such an interesting way to do it, because, you know, in some ways that's contradicted by the fact that they're on the cover of the, you know, the poster for the movie. But it's still interesting to me that they went in that direction.
Yeah, because they have to set up the story, you know, they got to set up the challenge, the whole actual Taming of the Shrew type, so, you know, which obviously it's based off. So they're not going to first on introduce, you know, Kat Stratford. They kind of got to give there's a reason why all this stuff is happening, and then it's kind of like start off with the, and that's, you know, pretty typical that a sort of rom-com high school thing would start off with the kind of like geeky types, and then they kind of like, and then you've got your scary people, your jocks, and then you've got your outsiders, and that's when they then get to bring in Joey Donner and Heath Ledger's character and all that sort of stuff. So I think it's quite clever.
Yeah, my memories of this movie are probably not exactly the same as yours, but I would have been a similar age. Like, I was probably 2001 or so when I did get around to watching it, and like, as you mentioned, being more family friendly than like a gross out American Pie sex comedy, basically, I think that definitely made it more appealing to people in my circle. And it was even at the time, like, it just felt like Heath Ledger was the next big thing. Like, A Knight's Tale came, and then he started doing serious movies like The Patriot and this kind of thing. So it did feel like a great welcome to Hollywood to have him in this role and show such range. Like, he starts off and he's this badass, and then he shows that he's actually this sensitive guy, which, you know, I do have some small issues with, like, the way that they've written the character, in that there's like almost no consistency, and like, why is he pretending to be a badass when clearly he's a big softy and he's you know, he's singing in the bleachers and doing all this stuff. Like, I'm like, there's no way he knows the words to this song if he's this tough bikey guy. But anyway, beside the point, yeah, great movie. Had no idea it was based on a Shakespearean play as a kid. Yeah. I think loosely based on it. But watching it now that I'm older, I'm noticing all these kind of references. You know, they call Cat a shrew, and his last name's Verona, which is obviously a Shakespearean reference too. Is that the kind of, like, have you noticed over the years you've picked up on more things as you get older?
Oh, absolutely, because there's no way back when this came out, so I was year 7, by the time I watched it I was year 8, there's no way I would have been thinking about Shakespeare at the time. So yeah, definitely, you kind of learn those cool little facts, literally decades later, and you're like, oh cool, that just makes it all that more special.
All right, do you have a guess for the Rotten Tomato score for this movie?
Ooh, 75?
69.
Oh, close.
Nice, yeah. It's so, you know, reasonably popular. The AV Club called it quirky, inventive, and brimming over with clever visual gags and colorful supporting characters. So I think it makes sense that it was well received. They said it was using Shakespeare as a jumping off point to playfully send up a society that doesn't know what to do with a strong woman.
Yeah, and that's what was so, like, I didn't sort of realize kind of how much that resonated beyond its release until a lot later. You know, at the time I wasn't really thinking, I guess I was more invested in the Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character when I was younger, because it's kind of like that whole, like, how do you impress a girl sort of thing. And then once you're older, you're kind of getting this, you're making sense of the whole vibe of, okay, she's kind of positioned as this, a bit of a rebel, and obviously, you know, very much has, like, feminist viewpoints and things like that, and references certain literature, and she's into all that sort of thing. And again, you don't really, when you're younger, don't really think about too much of that. But yeah, as you get older, particularly towards out of high school, it's kind of like, it just, there's so many little different layers with this film in terms of just, like, how they've positioned the characters and their slight little age differences and even physical differences as well, just making Joseph's character just that, yeah, as you said, that doe-eyed little kind of, like, he just wants to make an impression. And and, you know, I can imagine at the time coming across someone like Heath Ledger, like, his stature, it would have been intimidating. So I just love all those vibes that they capture in it.
Yeah, and, like, we all probably went to school with someone that seemed like they were too old to be there or didn't. You
know. Yeah, and they had all these sort of, like, I heard he did this, I heard he did that. Like,
yeah. Oh, man. And, like, from reading some of the stuff that's out on the internet, like, David Krumholtz, who plays Michael, the biggest geek in the movie, he did a bit of a retrospective article about this movie, and it just sounds like they had the best time. Like, they were all just such great friends filming it. They hit it off instantly. And I think, like, Heath Ledger was coming onto the set, like, a week or two after everyone else. And they were kind of concerned that he was going to, like, ruin the dynamic because they didn't know him. And he's, like, this guy from another country. And he got there and they all just hit it off even more. So I love those kinds of stories. And I think it shines through in the movie as well. Like, you can just feel, like, even the characters, like, Michael and what's Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character?
Cameron.
And Patrick, like, when they're together, even though they're all quite different, there's just a great chemistry there, and they just seem to get along so well.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, so I'm going to make you guess to see if you can tell the number one song when this movie came out.
Oh, and number one in Aria? Is that what we're doing?
I will do both, because I've got both here.
Oh, 99. I'm hazarding a guess it's going to be some form of boy band or girl band, but is it Backstreet's Back?
No, it's a good guess, because that is definitely of the time.
Yes.
So we're looking at June 24 for the Arias when this movie came out in Australia, and the number one track was If You Had My Love by Jennifer Lopez.
Oh,
which so is good. A banger of a pop tune.
It is, it really is.
Yeah, yeah. And then in March 31st on the Billboard charts, it was Believe by Cher.
Cher, I should say. Yeah, I realized I actually got my Backstreet timeline out of whack. It would have been more Larger Than Life era.
Okay.
Backstreet's Back was more your 97, so yeah, bit of a trip there. Right. Yeah, but again, those songs you just mentioned, I literally have them in my head right now. So, man, yeah. they're hooky. They stick with you.
1999 was such a great year for pop culture, I have to say. I don't know if it's like the age we are, but like looking at all the songs that were number one this year, it was just a real trip. I recommend that you go and have a look. And you know, this movie's, yeah.
Yeah, I think everyone was scared of Y2K, so it's like, let's get out all our best songs.
Yeah, totally. And like the movies of 99 as well, like there's so many classics, and this is just one of them in my opinion. So what have you done for me lately? We've talked about some of these guys already, but Joseph Gordon-Levitt, he actually had some voice roles that I didn't know about in The Last Jedi and Knives Out. He's working on a couple movies that I'm assuming they've been delayed because of the pandemic and everything, but Project Power is a movie that he's doing with Jamie Foxx.
Okay.
And then The Trial of the Chicago 7, which is a legal drama with Sacha Baron Cohen, and it's being written and directed by Aaron Sorkin. So that sounds really interesting. It's got a pretty solid cast, so keep an eye on that whenever it finally comes out.
Yeah, plus he's obviously doing all his hit record stuff he's been doing for a long time, so yeah.
Yeah. Julia Stiles, as I mentioned, someone that hasn't really had like a really massive career. Like the things that I've probably seen her in the most would be the Bourne movies, and she had like a reoccurring role on Dexter for like a whole season that was quite memorable. Mm-hmm. She was in
Step Up as well. Yes, that was the whole dancing. Yep, yep.
Yeah, yeah. And that was quite soon after this movie.
Mm.
So last year she was in Hustlers, and
yeah, that was good.
There's a movie this year that, again, delayed because of everything happening, but it's called The God Committee, and that is with Kelsey Grammer. Okay. So I don't know. Keep an eye out for that. That's an interesting pairing. She's also apparently the lead, or one of the leads, in Riviera, which is going into its third season, a TV series. I haven't seen that, but she's a great actor, so it's something that I'd check out if I came across it.
Yeah, she definitely kind of, Step Up was drama too. She definitely stuck in that drama vein then. I haven't really seen her do anything remotely comedy since, so.
Yeah, I mean, she's had some reoccurring kind of sitcom, like she's on The Mindy Project as like a reoccurring role.
Okay,
it's interesting because she does such great comedic work in 10 Things I Hate About You that she went in that other direction, but I guess that's what she enjoys. Larry Miller's a guy that I had fun talking about on our Nutty Professor podcast that I did a few months back with Salim. He's so cool. He's hilarious. He's one of Jerry Seinfeld's best friends that I mentioned. And you can see, like, everything he says in this movie is hysterical. Like, we'll probably get to him later. But he's one of, like, the most quotable characters in the movie. But he's kind of mostly known now for a podcast that he does. I think it's called the Larry Miller Podcast or the Larry Miller Show or something like that. And I think he gets
original title.
talking about comedy and news and that kind of thing. So I haven't seen him in anything for quite a while. But you know, just from watching this movie, if you enjoy his delivery, like it's the same kind of character in The Nutty Professor, someone that's just like so frank and like direct to the point and cutting and dry. And it's like, he's just a funny dude. A lot of respect for him.
He's one of those guys that I didn't mind the fact that he looked the same and acted the same in pretty much most of his appearances around that time. It's kind of like that's a guy that you don't really care, kind of just sticks in that vein because he does it so well.
Oh, yeah. He also, apparently in my research, was in the 10 Things I Hate About You TV show, which I never caught. But did you ever see that?
Well, because I was reading up on this just before we were going to record, and that it definitely sparked a little bit of a memory because I remember it coming out but not actually seeing it.
Right.
But I kind of feel like sometimes when they only latch onto one actor as kind of like the connecting point, it always kind of puts me off. Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of like because you like the movie so much, you probably go out of your way not to watch it.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't want to ruin it. Yeah. Gabrielle Union is someone that I pretty much only know her by name because she's married to the NBA legend Dwayne Wade. And of course, she was really big at this point because she was doing movies like this and Bring It On. She was, I think, one of the main characters.
Yep.
And she was in like She's All That or another one of those kinds of teen movies. But she's still working. She was recently America's Got Talent judge, so she's out there. She's a big celeb, but probably hasn't had like a hugely successful. Like, I'm not gonna say she's not hugely successful, but she hasn't had the stardom, I guess, that the others have from her work. Probably more just that she's married to this super duper star.
Yeah, yeah.
Larissa Olenek. It's kind of surprising that she didn't have the career we probably thought she would, based on how great she was as a teenager. Would you agree?
Yeah, because you sort of had, Alex Mack, and she is the show, essentially, plus a bunch of not so well dated CGI. And and then, of course, this, I thought, oh, great, this is going to really sort of project her. And then she kind of disappeared. And I remember seeing her way, way later pop up in Pretty Little Liars, of all things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just sort of like, I was like, That's Alex Mack. Like, I don't even call her by her actual name. It's just like, that is Alex Mack. I think I saw her in something else, maybe. She was in Mad Men, yeah. She recently did a video. It's like a retrospective thing about Alex Mack, like just recently. So that was cool to see. And she got to speak about all the characters and how it was at the time. But yeah, not much else from memory.
Cool. I just remembered, I think she was Tommy's boyfriend on Third Rock from the Sun as well, so there's a bit of chemistry.
Another tie-in, yeah, okay.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, very cool. Andrew Keegan, who plays Joey in this movie, I don't remember seeing him since this, but he's continued to work. He's been, he's been consistent. He's doing a recent movie with Sean Astin and Mickey Rourke called Adverse, which is a thriller of some kind, so...
Okay.
Good on him.
Good on Joey. Joey, yeah, eat me, Donna. Good on you, Joey.
The modeling career is still there as an option, I'm guessing. David Krumholtz, who I mentioned before as well, as Michael, he's so great in this movie. We'll probably get to it later, but there's so much visual comedy coming from him. I just love it. And he's someone that just pops up all the time.
Yeah,
great character actor. You know, you see him in movies like Elf, and you see him here and there. And I think the most recent thing of note is the Twilight Zone series. I guess it's a web series. It's probably streaming somewhere, but that's kind of a Jordan Peele run version of Twilight Zone.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Was he in? Because he's in The Santa Claus. So was he in Elf as well, or was that just
maybe I've mixed that up. I have mixed that up. Yeah, you're right. He's definitely in The Santa Claus.
Yeah,
yeah. Which is before this movie.
Yeah, so you get a slightly younger version.
How old is he?
The thing is, he dresses so much older than he needs to be in this film. So you're never really sure. So
it's hard to tell. Okay, what is the most 90s moment of 10 Things I Hate About You?
I think it's actually seeing the band, just like the type of band it is, the type of stuff they're wearing, just like the vibe of the club, and obviously they're like a through line in the film. But aside from that and just the general stuff that people's wearing or just the soundtrack, there's nothing to me that's specifically like overly 90s. I think maybe there's a scene where at the house party and you've got the three guys with the trilby hats on doing the sort of the head jiving, but that's about it.
There is so much if you drill down, but that's a really good thing you hone in on with the band. Like I wrote down the fact that there's a ska band at the prom. And everyone is into it. That's like, that is so 90s because, it would never happen now. It'd be like some kind of DJ or it'd be a rapper or something. It definitely wouldn't be a ska band.
What I liked about the band Letters to Cleo in this is they're clearly, I mean, obviously being ska and everything and the kind of like how the singer sounds, kind of channeling a bit of that No Doubt vibe. So I thought they were. It's just, and just really cool at the end to like finish the film on a rooftop performance. You know, why not? So
yeah, it's so weird, isn't it? Like it's the first thing that happens in the movie that's like surreal, and yeah. You're like, oh, but it's so cool that you can't not like it.
Exactly.
And I've actually found a cool little story about that. The lead singer was doing an interview and explained how they were like so freaked out up on that roof. Like they're on top of this school, and there's a helicopter like drive, like flying towards
fly by
them.
Yep.
And it's like a $500,000 scene because that's how much it costs for the helicopter to take
wow.
off and film. So they had like no choice but to get it in like one take, basically.
That's like half the film's budget, pretty much.
Yeah. And so it's like flying towards them and they're like getting really nervous because it kind of like drops and I assume it looks like it's coming right at you. But they have to keep playing and performing.
It makes for a good ending too, because just as the flyover happens, that's when it cuts to black as well.
Right. Okay,
yeah. So that's pretty cool. But and I love the whole thing of just like seeing, like you're hearing the song and then you can see them from quite a distance and it's just like slowly approaching. And I like that sort of thing where it's not just like a band in a singular cameo. They sort of really, I mean, obviously, I guess they weren't a huge, I mean, I had no idea who they were, so they weren't a huge, huge band, but, and they're playing covers of well-known songs. So yeah, I thought it was a good way to, as well as use them in the scene, you know, when they go to the club and everything, when he first tries to play to Kat's interests. So yeah.
There's another band that I had heard of, Save Ferris, that's also at the prom, because it's kind of like they play and then the band switch. And
yes.
It's the song that's dedicated to her or whatever. So yeah, a lot of ska and a lot of 90s music in general. We got some spider bait in this movie. How awesome is that?
That is cool. Like it's another way to rep Australia as well. Yeah. Heath Ledger, spider bait.
Yeah. I wonder if he had anything to do with it, but we'll probably never know. There's a few other things that I wanted to mention for being super 90s. One is the fact that no one has a phone. Like, I don't think you see a mobile phone in the whole thing.
Exactly.
Even though, like, they would have... The rich kids probably had phones. Like, they had phones in Clueless. This came out in 99, so it's, like, right at the end of the 90s.
I kind of gather that the type of school they're going to, it wasn't exactly, like, a big private school or anything, so maybe that's the case. And like maybe just someone like Joey Eat Me Donna would have one, and that's sort of about it. Yeah
But it stood out to me so much when Joey comes to pick up Bianca for the prom and she's not there, and he's just what, she's not here? And I was like, if that happened now, he would be like on his phone, he'd be texting her, he'd be calling her, he'd be like looking at Instagram and seeing, oh, she just posted a photo or that kind of thing. But I'm eating into a future category already.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
I should probably stop talking about that. And then the only other thing I wanted to mention is when the dad says, those damn Dawson's River kids sleeping in each other's beds.
Yeah.
I was like, yes, Dawson's Creek reference.
Dawson's Creek,
super
yeah.
90s. You couldn't have that joke in there now because people would just be like, what's Dawson's River? Like,
yeah.
What is it?
Yeah.
And then you have like Heath Ledger mentioning the Spice Girls. Like, I didn't sleep with a Spice Girl. There's a Marilyn Manson reference. Yeah. So great, great pop culture references to kind of tie it into that period.
Definitely.
What is the most iconic scene?
I think it'd have to be Patrick singing the song.
Yeah. It's up there for me. That's one of the two that I jotted down. It's so out of character for him, as I mentioned before. Like, how does he know the lyrics to this song? I don't know. But because I feel like the only reason I know the lyrics is because of this movie.
Oh, exactly. I had no idea, and then I didn't realize after the fact, oh man, this is because you recognize the chorus. I was like, this is a quite a big hit. But and then obviously parodied in Not Another Teen Movie. But I think between this and then, Kat reading the poem at the end, they're at least the two ones that I immediately think of when I'm thinking of this film, aside from other little quirky things that I find funny.
Yeah, you're right. It's impossible to hear that song and not think of this movie for me.
Mm.
And the poetry reading, you're right, like that's the name of the movie.
Yeah.
By the way, great name for a movie, 10 Things I Hate About You. Instantly, you're like, what? What are the... What is that about?
What are
like,
the 10 things? When are we going to get to that? Yeah. Yep.
And apparently I counted, there's 13 things in that list, in that poem.
Yeah, right.
So I guess you can pick the 10 that hurt you the most. But
yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, the story behind that is pretty cool. Like, Julia Stiles apparently nailed it in one take, and the crying was improvised. That wasn't written into the script. But it's such a big part of the movie, because when I was watching it, I was like, okay, the prom. The prom's always the big scene in the teen movie. It's always the big build-up to the prom. And they kind of skip over the prom pretty quickly. Like, there's a couple of scenes, there's the punch, and then it's done. And you don't see any of, like, you don't see people kiss. You don't see, like, how the night ends for anyone. It's kind of anticlimactic in that sense. But that's because the poetry reading is the climax of the movie, really. It's the heart. It's it's Kat being sensitive, and it's Kat being vulnerable in front of
of
everyone, not just in front of Patrick.
Because the entire film she's been putting up she puts up a bit of a front, and she's only like little bit by bit becomes more honest and open with Patrick, and then this is just like And this is the thing, obviously there's like the storyline with her and the past with her and Joey, and then she's just decided to kind of like, you know, as she says, do things on her own terms and that. And so she is very hesitant to even like entertain this Patrick guy. And then so when she finally does open up to him and kind of like they're growing that romantic relationship, and then she finds out, that's what makes it such an emotional scene, because she finally built up to that point. And then gets completely let down, and she's gutted. And I think she really channeled that into that reading. Just when she starts crying, I always start getting really, like I get goosebumps, and I start to feel quite, so my face starts getting a bit hot, kind of like, I feel both embarrassed for, like, in the situation that, you know, it might be having someone read that in your class, but then also I feel really sorry for her and what happens and how betrayed she's felt, so...
Do you think Patrick got off easy by just dropping a fender in her car and that's it? All forgiven.
I mean, yeah, it was pretty, because she didn't put up to, you know, she finds a guitar, you know, kind of like, you're not going to get away that easy. And then he charmingly, as Heath Ledger does and this character does, kind of charms his way out of it. And then it's all kind of cool. So
I think she could sense that despite the dog act of taking money, he did really care for her, and he did really, like, he just cared for her, and by spending all the money he got paid on her, I think that was like a sign that it was clearly wasn't just for the money.
Absolutely.
If he's giving it back to me.
Plus, he doesn't seem like a person that would generally have much money anyway, so it's like, well, where did he, you know, it's not like he just... He's not like a Rich, Joey Donner, and can just drop it, you know, pull out a, you know, but buy himself an apology sort of thing. So
yeah, that's true. So we'll give that a tick of approval. There's one other scene I have to mention, and maybe it's not the most iconic, but it has one of the most iconic parts in it, and I think that it's the best sequence, and it's the house party.
Yes, yes,
it's so good. Like, we get Michael constantly getting rejected by girls. We get him telling them that he has a Toyota, as if that's like some kind of pickup line. what's
his,
the make of the car?
His confidence is so funny. Oh man,
it's like to sell or something. It's like,
yeah. He's like, I actually have a whatever, and he's kind of like nodding, and they're like, all right, and that means what?
And then it's just a really important like hinge in the movie as well, because it's Cameron getting rejected for the first time. And Joseph Gordon-Levitt playing that so well. Yes. And like, you can just see, it's like Ralph Wiggum. Like, you can see the moment that he's heartbroken too. And then you have like Bianca going off with Joey and kind of realizing that he's actually a dork. Even though he's this like tough, rich guy model, he's like got no self-awareness, and he thinks that he's interesting, and he's talking about his modeling
career.
No one really cares. So I think that's a turning point for her. Then you have Kat getting blasted, and she gets up on the table and dances, and that's obviously, like, I think that was something that was just... It landed her a role, apparently, in Save the Last Dance, because she had some real moves.
That's the one I was thinking of, because is she in Step Up, or was I just thinking of Save the Last Dance? Anyway, one of those situations.
Save the Last Dance, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then that kind of really shows that, you know, she... all this time has ever wanted to make a fool of herself since she got, you know, messed over by Joey, and then it's just kind of like she just takes it out on herself by drinking excessively, really. And then from there, that leads you up to the swing scene as well with her and Patrick, which is quite good. But and you also get her Bianca's friend just kind of just like, fine, I'll go off with Joey, like, you're lost.
Yeah.
And you kind of get to see that her friend is just kind of like this shallow sort of type. Yeah.
Yeah, and then it's the first time as well that you see there's a lot more to Patrick. Like, he gets deep with not only Kat later, but with Cameron when he's like down in the dumps, and he's like, "Don't let anyone ever make you feel like you don't deserve what you want. You know, go for it." And that's not only a great quote, but it's a great moment in the movie.
Oh, exactly.
And then like, obviously, you have on the other side Cameron kind of stepping up to Bianca and saying, just because you're beautiful doesn't mean you can treat people like they don't matter. And that is just such a great line. And, you know, if we're talking about how we relate to this kind of dorky guy that's trying to catch a girl's attention, like, I think a lot of guys could probably think like, or live vicariously through that and be like, yeah, I wish I said that to a girl in my school.
Exactly. And the cool thing was, like, she starts off and she's popular, but she's not kind of like the mean girls style. You know, she's very, very kind of innocent, obviously controlled by her dad and everything. And so that's also the interesting development, just seeing the balance of, like, they're at the party. She then is just like, you know, has a little bit of an argument with Cameron, and then she realizes that, oh no, her friend is just like a Joey, essentially. So then that's a good turning point as well. And then you kind of, from there, you get more interaction with her and Cameron. And then that's where their little relationship is sort of growing in the background while you're focused on Kat and Patrick.
Yeah, true. And that is a good segue into, I think, what holds up the best. And I've written down a bunch of things, but one of the ones I want to talk about is how authentic this movie feels.
Yes.
How truly teenage it feels, how they've captured the essence of what it meant to be a teenager in the late 90s. And one of the things that really, I was going to complain about it, but then I realized how great it was, is how much all the characters suck as people.
Yeah.
Like, if we can break it down, the guys, they suck because they're paying someone to take Kat out on dates. Like, that's manipulative and cruel. Bianca sucks. Like, she really sucks because she's so mean to Cameron and she tricks him into thinking that he has a shot with her when she's just interested in Joey. And she doesn't think about his feelings at all.
Absolutely.
Chastity sucks because she just betrays her best friend instantly and is just totally, like, it's almost like comically evil the way that she's just suddenly not her friend anymore.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
And then Kat also has her moments where after Patrick is a white knight in a true sense and takes care of her, and he, you know, holds her while she's throwing up, and he drives her home, and he actually turns down her kiss because he doesn't feel like it's appropriate and doesn't want to take advantage of her.
Yeah.
Like, he's being a great dude, and then she's just, like, pissed at him the next day, and she's, like, you know, the anger of a thousand suns, and she doesn't want anything to do with him. And I'm like, you're meant to be this woke kind of like feminist and you aren't seeing that this guy has done like the best thing for you. Like, that sucks, but it's also typical of a teenager and the way that they're so emotional and they're not thinking things through. And before anyone says that I'm being sexist, this movie was written by two women. And I think that they're clearly bringing their experiences to the table. Like, the name of the movie is based on a poem that they had written in their diary.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that is a very interesting scene that you bring up, because to me it's almost like she's had this bad. She conducted herself and has set herself in a certain way since the Joey experience. And so I feel like it's almost like she was just assuming that's what he might have been. She was kind of blind to all his good actions and everything and the way he's taking care of her, and just maybe kind of defaulting into that. Okay, well, I guess I better do this thing then. I guess we better kiss and whatever happens afterwards. So then it's almost just like, then she has this expectation, whether she kind of really, really wants to or not. And then it's like, she then gets the what to her is the rejection and reacts to that, which I think is just such exactly such a teenage thing. So I don't think it's I think it is it's a good way to bring some balance to the character rather than her just being genuinely kind of like angry at people all the time.
Yeah, and I said, it was something that bothered me to start with, because typically in a movie, I would be bothered by like characters that aren't acting in a way that I think makes logical sense.
Yep.
But then I'm like, oh, they're teenagers. Like, I remember being a teenager. We did just stupid stuff.
Yeah,
all the time,
why did I do that? Yeah.
Yeah, you don't think about other people's feelings. You don't think about how they might interpret things. And it's just, that makes it authentic to me.
Exactly. And like, even the classic thing of being in high school, it's just kind of like, you actually, like, I remember, like, and like with this movie, you've got all these different social groups and you kind of like say things in public when there's other people around or certain expectations from the groups that you are in that afterwards you feel terrible about. You're like, look back and why did I even say that? That's really mean.
Yeah.
But it's just that peer pressure kind of mentality. And I kind of think that just having those sort of like natural teenager flaws throughout the film again makes it authentic.
Yeah, definitely, you're right. Like especially when you're a teenager, I guess some people never grow out of it, but like trying to be funny is such a motivator to say mean things or things that just are insensitive and you just don't think about it in the moment. But yeah,
exactly. And
you know, as the movie goes on as well, before we move on to the next thing, it becomes really clear that the way that Bianca and Kat are, you know, they're total opposites, but it all comes down to like they've got trauma and they're traumatized by the loss of their mother, and the way that Bianca seems to have reacted is by becoming popular and getting validation through, you know, attention from boys and being, you know, talking about Sketches and Prada and all this kind of stuff. And then the way that Kat has reacted and dealt with her trauma is by kind of going into her shell and rejecting everyone else around her. So I do like that they found a way to have it make sense that these characters are the way that they are.
Yeah, there was that defining moment and then they then split on different paths.
Mm-hmm. Totally. What did you have for holding up the best, Simon?
I just think generally like Heath Ledger's charm is just so... like, you can't stop smiling at it. Like, he's kind of cheeky and he kind of, like, he introduces this bad boy and then he kind of unfolds. So I think that the general relatability of this movie, particularly with Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and just, again, how he looks. Because, you know, as you mentioned at the start, a lot of these teen films often feature 20-something-year-olds, but he definitely looks of the age he should be. I think even just having Krumholtz as Michael, and he's just full of that. Like, everyone had that friend that thought that they knew everything. He's just full of all his misguided advice, and it's just the funniest thing. All those situations they end up in, and even the idea of him be like, you know, the last party I went to was Chuck E. Cheese. Now it's some real fun. It's just kind of like, and he's like combing his eyebrows. It's the best.
Yeah, he's so good. Like, when he walks into the pub and he's, first of all, he's like, don't touch anything. You'll get hepatitis. But it's almost the funniest part of the movie, at least to me, for whatever reason.
Yeah.
It's like he walks past the pool table and he just picks the up ball. The ball.
and then like he picks up the ball, the guy misses the shot, and then he chucks it in his hand and then puts it back on the table. Yeah. So good. So smooth as well.
It's making me laugh now.
Yeah, it's
so
awesome.
Funny. Like, it's just such a subtle thing. It's not a line. It's just it's just physical comedy, and it's great.
That's awesome.
And the other things I had were just how quotable the movie is. Like, we mentioned that before. My insurance does not cover PMS. Like, there's just so many great
PMS. Yeah,
there's just so many great like one-liners.
Oh, I love
the script is super clever.
I love the Walter. No drinking, no drugs, no kissing, no tattoos, no piercings, no ritualistic animal slaughters of any kind.
And then he's like, "Oh, I'm giving you ideas."
Yeah, oh, it's so good. But even the whole, like, we haven't even mentioned yet, but the whole Allison Janney's character with just the whole writing of the erotic novel, like, in between her little spare moments, it's just...
Yeah.
And she is essentially, you know, a much smaller sort of side character, but she has appeared in so much, like, well, prior, but since then as well, going on to things like huge. Juno and everything, so...
West Wing.
Yeah. So many things, but... yeah, that's just kind of like a cool little sort of like comedy side part to it. Yeah,
definitely. And like going back to like the authenticity of the teenageness is like, it's the way that I remember teenagers talking, like the sarcasm and like the way that people would insult each other. It's just, I don't know if kids are still like this. I'm not down with the kids these days, yeah. You know? being 32 years old. But for the time, it was so, and maybe like the movie being so popular influenced the way that people talked at my school or whatever, but it just seems so on point.
I think for me, just one last one that I always love, like you mentioned the pool ball one, but another Michael one, again, it's kind of like harkens to sort of that type of like little quick sort of Jim Carrey style comedy, but when he gets on the little postie bike and then he like veers off down the hill and then he does a bump, he goes, my balls. Like it's just, it's just like a goofy little like, what, and you can only just hear it. And every time I crack up.
Oh, that's great. Great. This might be a bit harder, but what holds up the worst?
This was really hard to even, I think, style wise, it's clearly the late 90s, but that's not a bad thing. I think the acting's still really great. Like when you compare this to, you mentioned American Pie earlier, American Pie seems so stilted and so much space in between lines, whereas this has just got the conversational flow so well. And I don't think there's no particular comedy bits that seem cringy or anything to me that spring to mind, unless you have any.
I mean, Bianca does call someone a retard at some point, which is just like, you wouldn't put that, I don't think you'd put that in a movie now. It's not,
yeah, but considered. Then I kind of think that's like I don't know if you've seen mid-90s, but that's full of like all these sort of like offensive references that people said back then. So it's kind of like it is a window. It's a horrible thing to say, but it is 100%. A window of time, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and I guess that's where you don't watch it and go, this movie's bad because it has this in it. It's just like, it's not something that holds up. It wouldn't hold up now, I guess. And there's a couple other things like that, you know, the flashing your boobs at a teacher. I don't know, like, that seems like it would be a bit more controversial now.
Yeah, it is weird, though, because of my perceived age of her and Patrick, they just seem like they're well past high school, that I keep forgetting that she is meant to actually be a student as well, whereas I think if that was like Bianca's character or something, it'd be different. And it's still like escape through the windows, and then they go on, like, that leads into the whole like date with the paintball and everything, which is a great scene. But yeah, I never really thought too much about that, but I, looking back, like the context of it, it's pretty I haven't known of anyone to do that, so there you go.
No, I mean, like, let's if we're going to be really serious about it, it's technically like sexual assault, isn't it?
yeah and he looks so baffled as to like, I don't even know what. Oh, but that teacher, oh man, one of my favorite scenes. I didn't mention iconic scenes, the one with the you got putt, don't you. Oh, that is so good.
It's funny. But you know what? I noticed he's like, you got bloodshot eyes. And I look at the guy's eyes. They're not bloodshot.
They're
perfectly normal. They're just white eyes. Like, they couldn't have given him contact lenses or something.
I just love it when he's like, you look pretty nervous. You're sweating like a pig. Like, but I do agree. He just kind of looks like a bit of a dropkick, but not particularly bloodshot. Stone. So, yeah.
I just think they could have, like, rubbed his eyes or something.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Put a bit of pepper in his eye. So, otherwise, you mentioned, like, the fashion. Like, it's, you know, it's 90s. It is what it is. But the prom dress that Bianca wears is just awful. Like,
very puffy. Yeah, it's almost verging on 80s, yeah.
There's, like, a midriff showing and then, like, the puffy bottom. I was just like, I guess it was cool back then, but yeah, it's just laughable now. The pork pie hats or the trilby hats, like, comically 90s. There's as far as like how well the movie was made, you're right, like there's not really anything I can say, except that there's one kind of piece that's missing to me, and maybe it was like something that they cut for time, but there's a scene in the library where they're practicing French, and Cameron and Bianca, like, she's basically asking him, why haven't you asked me to prom yet? And then the next thing you know, he's rocking up to take her to prom. Like, we never got the scene of him asking her
to prom
to go.
Yeah.
And it seemed strange for them to make a thing of it. Like, why haven't you asked me to go? And then next minute, they're going. And I just, like, it was from, like, a narrative perspective, I was like, oh, like, it's a bit, like, disconnected.
I guess the idea is you're meant to, he's still trying to figure out what she's just said. So maybe she leaves and then he then deciphers, like, does the translation, French translation, yeah. And then you're presuming that he's asked her in between. But, yeah.
I suppose. But it could have. I think they could have done it better. I'm just being a bit nitpicky there, but
I mean, yeah, yeah. Maybe he could have caught her on the way out from the library or something and figured out sort of what she said. Maybe, I don't know, but
I think like this kind of movie, like the way that you ask someone to prom would be like a significant thing, though. It's like a big deal, so I feel like that would have been a good scene to throw in there.
Yeah. Plus, I mean, I remember the whole trying to ask someone to your high school ball scenario. Like,
yeah,
it's like how do you do it? Where do you do it? When do you, like, sort of thing? And it is much more of a kind of like pivotal moment, I guess, in your life, yeah. Rather than, yeah, that, yeah.
I would have loved to see that. Anyway, maybe it's on the deleted scenes. have to go into a YouTube deep dive to find out. Is there anything in this movie that you think would offend people now? Who would be the most offended if this movie came out now?
I really struggled to think of something, because usually with 90s, it's quite easy to sort of pick out at least one or two things. But I think potentially some of Joey's sleaziness and his real determination with Bianca, but that is the character as well.
Yeah.
And I think the only other thing is potentially portraying feminism as like a completely outsider thing. Obviously, like between then and now, there's generally a lot more awareness and everything. So, and they were never really made out to be ridiculous or anything. They were just kind of like her and her friend. So that was just like a potentially maybe, but then that is her character. Is she's meant to be the shrew type? Like, she gets called that. So I don't really know. What about you?
I think you're right. Like, there's not really anything offensive in here, to me at least. Maybe like feminists, like, not that we're not feminists ourselves being men, but like, not, I think that some people might take issue with some of the gender stuff, but you know, you could probably say that about any movie, even movies that come out now. But I thought maybe teachers, because they're not portrayed to be that switched on and intelligent in this movie.
Yeah.
Like, you've got Daryl Mitchell, who plays the English teacher or the lit teacher. And he literally can't tell if she's being sarcastic or not.
I know. He's like, to the principal. And when he opens up with that kind of like rap style delivery, and she's like, yeah, I really enjoyed that. And it's just, again, another little vignette, another character that just adds that comedy in there. But yeah, that part is quite unrealistic.
Yeah. And Alice and Jenny, like, working on her like novel. 50 Shades of Grey, basically, on school time, like... Yeah, maybe a school teacher might take offense to that, but it's all harmless. There was like only one really reference to the fact that Heath Ledger is Australian in this movie, which makes me think that it wasn't written to be an Aussie. And I can't remember exactly what it was, but I remember thinking like, that is a stereotype that I don't agree with about Aussies.
Yeah, it is weird because they do the whole, like, you know, reference, he did this in San Quentin and he killed the guy and all sort of stuff. And it's not until, yeah, there's that one reference to Australia, and then everything else is just more about those rumors about, I don't know Marilyn Manson, I've never dated a Spice Girl, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I sort of didn't, I mean, maybe it's good that they didn't constantly poke out the fact that, hey, you're Australian, say something Australian sort of thing.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Kangaroos, mate.
Yeah.
Does 10 Things I Hate About You pass the internet relevancy test?
Well, the Patrick dancing on the stairs is very gif-able. You see the one with, like, Kat talking to Joey with the run-along now. I've seen that a few times. Often see Patrick with the Bunsen burner flame, putting his fingers through that.
Oh, yeah.
And then, obviously, the Kat getting upset at the when she's reading the poem at the end. So, there, I've seen at least those four, that's enough for it to be... at least somewhat relevant, I think.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's obviously not like a super relevant one, like basically any Jim Carrey movie, just because of the you know, strength of his facial
animation.
Yeah, yes. It's in itself makes it way more gif-able, I guess. But I think it's borderline, but we'll give it a passing grade for this.
Okay.
I mentioned it before, but how do you think smartphones and social media would change a movie like this now?
It wouldn't change too much, except for she would have been filmed being drunk at the party.
Totally. It would have been on Snapchat and stuff.
Exactly. Or there would have been footage of maybe Bianca discovers her history with Joey through seeing old footage of her with Joey at the party, or when she was dating him, or whatever that she mentions, rather than finding the underwear in her room. So I don't know. I think you can still, and again, this might be jumping ahead, but you can still quite easily make this now. And you can infuse, there wouldn't be any sort of, as you said, she's not there, Bianca's not there, so then it's he would then get on the phone. You'd introduce things like that, but I don't think you have to really gear the entire film around social media or anything. It's just sort of going to be what they do with a lot of those Netflix teen movies now, where you do see people using their phone and texting and little bubbles pop up on the screen, but that's sort of about it.
Yeah, it's not going to significantly tweak the movie, but it would just be a different flavor, I guess. And you're right, the dancing would definitely be a Snapchat or a tweet or something that goes semi-viral
through the school,
amongst the school. And I think, or it would be Facebook Live or something.
Yeah, yep, yep.
and there'd probably be some cyberbullying and that kind of thing. But yeah, for the most part, it'd be the same. Because it's just, as we said, it's a timeless movie. Could you make it today? What would the 2020 version be? I think it would hold up extremely well. If you picked this up and just dumped it in 2020, it would almost not need to change.
I'm surprised they haven't already. I'm surprised someone hasn't tried to do it already.
I mean, the cast would probably be more diverse. It's basically a bunch of white people apart from Chastity, friend.
I mean, no, you got Chastity, you got the teacher, the English teacher. Yeah.
As far as the main cast,
the main
who's getting
cast.
Most of the who's getting most of the lines? It's
I mean, I did think of that, but I think generally, and then maybe there's probably some other people in the school that just extras and stuff. But but yeah, you could easily make introduce more people into the lead role.
Yeah, and as far as teen movies now, I feel like they come out on Netflix more than anywhere else because
Kissing Booth and all that. Yeah,
yeah, maybe to all the boys I've loved before. And, you know, I'm sure there's others, and I'm just missing them because I'm not the target. But I don't know. I feel like if this movie came out now, I'm trying to think: would it interest me? Would it catch my attention? And it would have to be something where it gets these great reviews, and it makes me.
Yep.
Stop and go, okay, well, if everyone's saying it's amazing, then check it out.
And that's exactly the issue. I was saying this to a friend, you got such a huge following behind the American The Office. If that was launching new now amongst all the other stuff you have to choose from as a new series, I don't think there's any way it would make it to the amount of seasons it did, or nor have the impact.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, and that's it. I don't think you can launch, I hope if they did do a new version of this, it would be a cinema, a proper cinema release. But it seems all too easy for people to drop straight into Netflix, so.
Yeah. Now that I'm thinking of it, it's probably more TV series that tap into this vein.
Exactly.
Now on Netflix, Never Have I Ever was a fun one, and Sex Education's another great one. And even though I'm 32, I don't feel weird about watching these teenage stories because they're just really well told. And there's something about us that never forgets what it feels like to be that age. And part of that insecurity and trying to understand how the world works, that kind of never goes away.
Yeah, because to me, you take a movie completely different from this, but one that's obviously based around childhood, a movie like Stand By Me, created and made well before I was that age, but still entirely relatable about that whole your friends and guys and the type of way that you egg each other on and all that sort of thing. And so it's kind of I feel like this is another one like your Stand By Me and all these other movies, one that is just very timeless, because at the end of the day, people still go through grow up through childhood, puberty, and everything like that. So there's at least going to be some form of way that it can transcend to an audience.
Totally, yeah. And we see the same thing in video games as well. Like, we both play a lot of games. Life is Strange and Gone Home and these kinds of things where, you know, you're getting like a very angsty kind of teen drama, but, you know, it's even if it's a teenage girl, it doesn't mean you can't relate to it if you're open to it.
Exactly. And like, and with the fact that so many games have just pushed into that very like compelling storytelling and everything like that as well, beyond just being like a, hey, let's play a fun game sort of thing. So yeah, definitely, I agree with that.
All right, it's time for the Steve Buscemi Spark Plug Award.
Steve Buscemi,
a real spark plug.
There's a few nominees. We've got Allison Janney. She's obviously great in her brief appearances. I think she's only got two scenes, is that right?
Yeah, yes. Yep.
Yeah. The way they set her up, I'm thinking like she's going to be all through the movie because she's so great, but then they use her very sparingly. Daryl Mitchell as the other teacher is quite good. When he sends her to the principal's office for like being nice.
Oh, yeah, man. That's good. Yeah,
it's so good. It's so good. The only other one I had was the guy who played the... you'll have to remind me his name. The guy that throws the house party that's not meant to be a house party.
Bogie Lowenstein. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Bogie Lowenstein.
Like, oh, he is so good. Oh, he's, yeah. He's just like... Especially when everyone's going to crash the party, he's like, this must be Nigel with the brie. And then he's just like, gets absolutely crowded in on. And then when he does the golfing part with the rip it and grip it, he's all just that super chipmunky, just full on preppy. It's hilarious that they've kind of, they almost have these little like vignettes of these little side characters you only just see briefly. Yeah.
He's great. But out of these three, who do you think deserves the award for kind of lighting up the screen?
Oh, it would be Allison Janney's one, just because I think everyone always remembers that scene, even if there's only a couple. It's like, oh, how funny is that intro sort of thing? But yeah, and it's actually funny, yeah, sort of just briefly mentioning Bogey's character, is that is also a very iconic scene for me, is the dropping the party invites and then the sexy boy and then the very slow, dramatic, like pull down sort of thing. And I always get that song in my head just from that one little snippet. So, they're very effective with the soundtrack as well. You got the band, you got other songs tied in. You got the one of her in the bookstore with the Tracy Chapman song. That's always quite emotional too. So,
Yes, yeah, so similar to American Pie in that sense, where it does tap into like the 90s. Although I think this one probably has more older music as well. Yep. So it's not like everything is off the era.
Yeah. American Pie is definitely more like, here's a collection of pop punk sort of throughout type of thing, yeah.
And like, yeah, indie folk and that kind of thing.
Yes, yeah.
All right, so congratulations, Allison Janney. The award is yours. Last question before we let you go. Is it still a good movie? And I think, obviously...
Resoundingly, yes. It is, it to me... And I love 500 Days of Summer, but this is my favorite rom-com, just because everything we've covered, you know, just like all the range of the different types of characters and the quotability, relatability, all that sort of stuff. And I could just watch it at the drop of a hat. So yeah.
Yeah. It's definitely one that I will, not let myself go as long as I did without watching it, I think, because I realized that I love it. And it's just good to see Heath Ledger. Like, he's so missed, and I'm sure, you know, you being a WA boy, miss him as much as anyone. But just so much talent. And I recently watched A Knight's Tale as well, because it's one of my wife's favorite movies from back then. And he really just had the whole package, didn't he?
That movie. Those two especially, I think, pair. Because I don't know if you've seen Two Hands or that. That's like very much like a dark, like a violent sort of dark comedy. But that also, that was good for me, seeing him something like that, because that is an Australian film too. But just the types of roles he played were quite sort of far-ranging too as well. He didn't just play the kind of like charming but tough boy sort of thing.
Yeah, I think he seemed to get typecast, at least in some people's mind, as the kind of romantic lead, and obviously playing the Joker threw everyone out when it was cast initially, and people were like, who's this guy? Why is he? Why do they think he's going to be a good Joker? And he turned out to be amazing.
Absolutely.
It's just one of those things where you think, like, what would he have done? Mm. Like, where would he be now? Like, would he have reached, like, the levels of, like, a Leo or someone? Or would he, you know, would he have dipped into, like, rom-coms and, been more of, like, a McConaughey, where he does these serious movies and then he does, like, a rom-com every now and then to kind of, like, mix it up? And I think
he'd be probably between that and maybe a Jake Gyllenhaal.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of vibe. Yeah. I think he might.
I can see that.
He might tap into like something that's even more like comedy based as well, and then he could then go back and do like a thriller and stuff. So, yeah.
He just had so much range, obviously, and yeah, it's great. To, I guess not to end on a downer, but it's good that we have a movie like this that we can go back to and see like him at such a fresh part of his career, so like vibrant and full of energy and. And yeah, just how a good way to remember him, I think.
I think one of my funniest memories of Heath Ledger, though, is his first appearance on anything involving video was over in WA. We got a franchise called Chicken Treat, like a Red Rooster, and and he was on a Chicken Treat advert. Him and Michael Caton, and he's like. He's one of the workers, and Michael Caton's like the store owner, and he goes down, he sees the rotisserie chicken going, and he's like smiling, and he's just like, oh yeah, it's just like fresh roasted sort of thing. It's just so cheesy and so 90s and so warmly lit. But again, he just had that smile back then.
Yeah. Oh, it's such a great smile. Oh, man. All right. Well, thank you for joining us, Simon. It's been great to have you, and I'm sure we'll get you back again soon before too long. Is there anything you want to plug while we're here?
If anyone missed it on my episode with the mask, I'm from the music podcast Take My Tone, where myself and a different guest each week share and compare songs. So just search for that in your podcast player or go to takemytone.com.
Very, very good. I don't really have anything to plug, although I think around the similar time as this episode coming out, there's a Ghost of Tsushima spoiler cast up on the Hungry Gamers feed, so you can get onto that and hear Benny and Brendan from 8-Bit share their views along with mine on that game that we're all playing at the moment, or a lot of us are playing. Otherwise, you can leave your podcast reviews in Apple Podcasts, Podchaser, anywhere that does it. You can do that to help this podcast get the word out there. Give us the warm, fuzzy feelings deep inside. There's also the 8-Bit Patreon over at patreon.com/weare8bit. That's ATEBIT. And of course, as Brendan likes to say, that is how you can help keep the emotional lights on, as well as putting a bit of coin in the pockets of us hardworking podcasters. Simon, where can people find you on the socials?
So mainly active on Twitter with @precisepath.
Very good. And you can catch me at Jono himself. And dear listeners, we will say thank you for joining us again on Comedy Rewind. Until next episode, be kind.